Notice here that just in Revelation chapter 12, you see a very clear distinction made between Israel and the church. You see that God protects Israel, and God makes a distinction between Israel and the church. He loves both, and he protects both. Tonight we're in Revelation chapter 12, beginning there in verse 7 through the end of the chapter. My text has verse 17 there, and I'll explain the disparity. If your text says verse 18, I'll explain that here at the end. I want you to grasp this truth from the text, because I think that this one sentence, I think that it encapsulates, I think it summarizes neatly the purpose here of this text, and it's this, that while Israel and the church are the object of Satan's fury, they are ultimately the object of God's love and his protection. While Israel and the church are the objects of Satan's fury, they are ultimately the object of God's love and his protection. You remember there in verse 1 through 6 of chapter 12, John sees a vision which is essentially a cosmic vision of heavenly history. It is a cosmic vision. It's a vision literally there in the skies is what he sees. He sees a woman crowned in majesty and in glory. She is giving birth to a male child, and at that same time, he sees a great, magnificent red dragon, a giant red dragon, and that red dragon is waiting to devour the child when the woman gives birth. But when the woman gives birth to the child is caught up to heaven. And the dragon begins to be furious, and he begins to chase the woman, and he chases her into the wilderness, where the text says that she has a place prepared for her, a place where she is protected, where she is nourished for 1,260 days, 42 months, or 3.5 years. And that essentially is a cosmic picture. It is a gigantic overview of the history of heaven and its relation to earth, because we know that earthly reality is shaped by heavenly reality. That is really another overarching truth of the entirety of chapter 12, that the things that take place in the heavenlies are directly reflected here in earth. That the history of heaven is the history of earth. The things that take place here on earth are the things that have taken place in heaven to some degree. It is a reflection at least. And so the woman there that John sees in the sky is representative of Israel. And Israel goes through its many travails, its many trials, and its sufferings mounting up to birth pains, in which through Israel, the Son of God would be born to Mary there in Bethlehem of Judea. And Jesus lives a perfect life here on the earth, dies on the cross, is raised from the dead. And before Satan can accomplish his work of thwarting the works of God through Jesus, Jesus ascends into heaven. He is caught up into heaven. And Satan is furious that Jesus has accomplished his work. And so from there on out, from the ascension of Jesus up until today, Satan has pursued the people of Israel. He has pursued the Jews from one corner of the earth to the next, to all four corners, in fact, and they have been scattered. In the immediate sense, they were scattered into the wilderness. There in 70 AD, as Jerusalem was destroyed, they were scattered to the wilderness, and they found sanctuary. They found protection from their enemies. Every time that Satan has mounted an attack against the Jewish people, they have found sanctuary in the earth, in various places, in various nations that have allied themselves or aligned themselves with Israel. And they have protected the Jews, and they have found places of sanctuary. And that's verses 1 through 6 of chapter 12. And in the rest of chapter 12, 7 down through the end there, what you see essentially is a zoomed in picture. You see a detailed, in-depth picture of the fall of Satan. See, it's mentioned very briefly there in chapter 3, or in verse 3 of chapter 12. And another sign appeared in heaven, behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his heads 7 diadems. Verse 4 says, his tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them down to the earth. What you see here in 7 down through the end of the chapter is the zoomed in picture of what took place there when Satan and a third of the angels were cast out of heaven. We looked at two passages there last week, one of them from Ezekiel and the other Ezekiel 28 and the other from Isaiah chapter 14, about how Satan, who was at that time called Lucifer, that was his good name when he was not a fallen angel. He had become puffed up with pride because he was the most beautiful of all the angels. He was the highest archangel there, but he became puffed up in his own arrogance and in his own abilities that were given to him by God. And in his arrogance, he decided that he himself would ascend to the throne of God. And you remember the result of that? He was cast down out of heaven. He was cast down to the earth. And apparently a third of the angels were following Satan's lead, and they were cast down as well. And that third of the angels there in heaven are now what we call demons. That is the origin of Satan and demons here on this earth and also there in the heavenlies, though not in heaven, because as we've read, they have been cast down. So verse 7 through the end of the chapter is really a zoomed in picture of what really took place there in the heavenlies. Look in verse 7, it says, "Now war arose." Here we go with the zoomed in camera focus of heaven. "Now war arose in heaven, and Michael was an archangel. He is an archangel. I don't know why I say that in the past tense. But in Jude chapter 1, there's only one chapter in Jude, so I don't know why I say one. But in Jude verse 9, just out of habit, I guess, in Jude verse 9, we read about Michael. Michael has an interesting history, an interesting past. Michael is an archangel there in heaven. If you believe in Jesus, you've called on Jesus as your Savior, you're born again. When you die or the Lord returns, you will see the archangel Michael face to face. And he is a magnificent being, a glorious being, one of the highest of all of the angels. In fact, the Bible tells us in this text that he is essentially one of the commanders of a number of angels there in heaven. He is a commander in the Lord's army, a commander of angel armies. In Jude chapter 1, only one there, verse 9, what you read about is that Michael was also the one who fought with Satan there on Mount Pisgah, there in the land of Moab, in the plains of Moab, as Moses was brought up to Mount Pisgah and he was allowed to look over into the promised land. You remember that Moses was not allowed to go in the promised land. And as Moses looked over into the promised land, the Lord took his life. The Lord made Moses to die. And it says that Satan came and he tried to fight Michael. He fought Michael for the body of Moses. And Michael took the body of Moses and went and buried him secretly in the plains of Moab. That instance right there just goes to show you, it's just another example of how Michael is not only an archangel, he is not only a commander of the Lord's armies there in heaven, but he is also a protector of the people of Israel, as it was personified in his protection there of Moses' body on Mount Pisgah in the lands of Moab. You also see in the Old Testament, specifically in the book of Ezekiel and also in the book of Daniel, Daniel 10 and Daniel chapter 12, that Michael is fighting or has been fighting against demonic forces, it seems, from the beginning of creation, and especially highlighted in the life of Israel, as he would fight the angels who had sided with the evil in the world to conquer the people of Israel. Satan has set himself against everything that is the object of God's affection. He has set himself against God's Christ, Jesus. He has set himself against God's people, his chosen people, Israel. And he has set himself also against God's people, the church. Satan is opposed to everything that God stands for and that God shows affection for. And so there is an army there, a war, it says in verse 7. "Now war arose in heaven, Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon." You remember there in verse 3, we read about the dragon. That is Satan. That's his name. Also, his name is Lucifer. He is a red dragon. And Michael and his angels are fighting against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. "Oh no, what shall we do? The enemy is attacking. What shall we do? Satan is making war against God's creatures." But look at verse 8. but he was defeated. That's going to be a line that's repeated over and again in the Bible, even to the end of the chapter. Satan decides that he is going to oppose God in every way, but he was defeated. Satan decides that he's going to do this and this, but he was defeated. That's why I said almost sarcastically, "Oh no, what shall we do?" But he was defeated. That's the line of Scripture. It's not to fear Satan, it's to fear God. Fear him who can destroy both soul and spirit in hell. It says that Satan is defeated, verse 8, but he was defeated, and there was no longer any place for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent, who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. Jesus tells us very succinctly in John chapter 8, verse 44, exactly who Satan is, exactly what he is after. Though he presents himself as an angel of light, the Apostle Paul tells us, Jesus reveals to us exactly who Satan is. John 8, 44, Jesus says, he was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks out of his own character, for he is a liar and the father of lies. Satan is not interested in helping anyone out. He lies to the whole world, not in order to give them good things, not to give them enjoyable things. He lies to people in order to kill them. That's why he tells them about all the fun that people will have with narcotics and with alcohol and with driving crazy and with breaking God's commandments, as if God was keeping good things from people. God's not keeping good things from people. He's keeping people from death. And Satan presents these things as good things. He presents sin as good things in order to, just as Jesus said, to steal, to kill, and to destroy. Think in your own life of people affected in your own family. Maybe you are one of those who's experienced trials and difficulties with narcotics or with alcoholism or with many of the other commandments of God that you have broken. And you think about the loss that is incurred because of those sins, about the death that is incurred because of those sins, about the things that have been stolen from those people or even from you or I myself. Satan is a murderer, and he's a liar. He has been from the beginning. He says there in chapter 12, verse 3, that Satan is pictured as a great red dragon, red being the color of blood. I don't think it's any stretch by any means to say that that red is significant there, his color being a murderous color, because that's who he is. Or that his character is symbolically pictured as a dragon, as a mythical creature that comes up out of the seas, and it is ferocious, and it is devouring at will. That is who Satan is. He's a devourer. He's a devastator. He is a killer. He wars against God. He wars against God's angels there in heaven, but he was defeated. And he was thrown down, it says there in verse 9. He was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. Now look at verse 10. After the great defeat of Satan, look at what verse 10 says. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brothers have been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. Verse 10, again, while this is a zoomed-in picture of the war that took place there in heaven as Satan and his angels are cast out, verse 10 is not so much of a zoomed-in picture of what took place. It is in heaven, it is a picture of what took place here on earth. It's a picture not only of the victory over Satan there in the heavenlies, it is a picture of the victory that took place here on the earth through the person and the work of Jesus. You notice there in verse 9 that he is called that ancient serpent. Does that ring a bell of a text in your mind? Early on in Genesis chapter 3, when you read about the fall of mankind, the first man and woman, as they fell there in the garden, who were they deceived by? They were deceived by Satan, who was pictured there in the garden as a serpent. And you remember how God cursed the man there, cursed the ground, that he would work by the sweat of his brow, and the ground would yield to him thorns and thistles. And he would have to eat of the ground for the rest of his life. And the woman, she's also cursed there with the pain of childbearing. And the serpent is cursed with crawling on his belly for the rest of his life. And there is something peculiar that is said there in the midst of the entire cursing that goes on in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. God says, "I will put enmity between you," the serpent he's talking to, "between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head." You notice how God there, he's talking about offspring. He's talking about the plural. All those who would come from Eve's posterity. All of her descendants, that Satan would be at enmity with them. But you notice how God switches to the singular there? "I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." Many theologians call that the first gospel, the proto-evangelium. It is the picture of the Christ child, the offspring of the woman, crushing the head of Satan, doing away with Satan's authority, doing away with his power to kill, to steal, and to destroy, just as he did there in the garden, as he took everything that was good that God made and he perverted it. Even there in the curse that came about in Genesis 3, God was foretelling us the gospel that would take place. How that ancient serpent would have his head crushed by the offspring, singular, pointing to one person that would crush the head of the serpent. Jesus definitely accomplished this in his work here on the earth as he ministered and walked this land. And the Bible is very explicit about Jesus conquering Satan in his ministry. When you think about Jesus casting out demons in the Gospels, that's what you read about, the casting out of demons. Many times what we think about is that, well, that's just Jesus doing a marvelous work. That's Jesus doing a miracle. That's Jesus showing that he's stronger than Satan. Which all of those things are true, but they don't really get down to the deepest heart of the issue of what Jesus is doing there. Jesus is not merely just demonstrating that he is stronger than Satan. He's not merely demonstrating that he is the Son of God. What he is in fact doing is he is coming down into Satan's domain and he is robbing his house. He is stealing people who are dying. He is stealing them from Satan and he is giving them back over to God. He is plundering this man's house. He's plundering Satan's house. In Luke chapter 11, you remember when the scribes and the Pharisees, they had seen Jesus cast out a demon. You remember their comments about Jesus? He casts out demons, how? By the power of Beelzebul. He casts out demons by the power of Satan. Very interesting what Jesus says in response to them. Luke chapter 11, 19 through 22, listen to this. "And if I cast out demons by Beelzebul," by Satan that is, "by whom do your sons cast them out? Therefore they will be your judges. But," here it is, verse 20, "if it is by the finger of God that I cast out demons, then the kingdom of God has come upon you." You see the picture Jesus is painting? My house is come down from heaven and it is planted right in the middle of Satan's domain. That's what you're seeing. That's what he's explaining to them. He's not an exorcist. He's the Lord. He continues, and it gets even more interesting. Verse 21 of Luke 11, when a strong man, fully armed, guards his own palace, his goods are safe. And that's what Satan had been doing here on the earth from Genesis chapter 2. When he entered the garden, he deceives the woman there at the beginning of Genesis 3. And he sets up his house here on the earth. He is a strong man in his palace, fully armed. Who is going to take him on? Man can't take him on. Who is man in contention with angels? And yet here is Jesus, verse 21, when a strong man, fully armed, guards his own palace, his goods are safe. But, I love that word in the Bible, but when one stronger than he attacks him and overcomes him, he takes away his armor in which he trusted and divides his spoil. That is Jesus' explanation of his casting out of demons here on the earth. He is plundering enemy territory. And he is coming into Satan's house while Satan stands there fully armed with all of his lies and all of his deceit. And Jesus comes and sets up shop right in the middle of his home. That's what Jesus has done. He has conquered Satan. He has disarmed the powers and the principalities and the rulers in the heavenlies. And he has taken his throne and everything has been put under his foot. That's why God says that heaven and earth have been given to Jesus as his footstool. Because he's come down and he's set up his shop right in the middle of Satan's supposed domain. So look at what Jesus did in verse 10. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation, the forgiveness of sins has come, and the power and the kingdom of our God come down from heaven, and the authority of his Christ have come. Satan can't give Jesus a kingdom. Jesus has come and robbed his own kingdom. Jesus has come and purchased his own kingdom here. And the authority of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And they, very interesting verse 11, and they, verse 10 talks all about the victories of Jesus. That would be expected, would it not? That the Son of God would overcome an angel? It's expected. The angel is created. But in verse 11, what you see is that not only has Jesus been victorious in verse 10, but he has extended that victory to people of faith. He has extended that victory to all who call on the name of the Lord. They shall be saved. So verse 11, he says, and they have conquered him, that is Satan, the dragon. And they have conquered him. How? By the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. For they love not their lives even unto death. See, Jesus extends the victory that he has claimed here on the earth through his death, through his resurrection, through his power over Satan, his conquering of death. He's extended that victory over to believers. So what is it? There are two things here. There are two things here that it says that have to be overcome, or that are implied that have to be overcome. What do believers have to overcome that Satan does? What do believers have to overcome that Satan does? The first thing that you see that believers, that you and I must overcome if we are to be in fellowship with God, the first thing that we must overcome is the accusations of Satan. Look at what it says again there in verse 11. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb. The blood of the Lamb is the way that you and I and all sinners on this earth, all sinners who are reconciled with God, the blood of the Lamb is the way by which we overcome the accuser, the accusations of Satan. The Bible tells us that early on, before these events took place, before Jesus did his work here on the earth and cried out, "It is finished," he's not just talking about his crucifixion. He is talking about the full, ultimate plundering of Satan's kingdom. He's saying the last thing stolen has been put in the back of the truck, and I'm driving off. It's finished. The Bible tells us that before this, when Satan was in heaven, as we'll see in a second in Job, what does Satan do both day and night? He accuses the brethren. He says, "Hey, God, have you remembered Jordan? Have you remembered him? Lord, you know all of his sins. Lord, you know how he acted when he was younger. Lord, you know of his arrogance. Lord, you know of his many failures. Lord, you know of the things that he said. Lord, you know of the things that he's thought. Lord, don't forget those things. Lord, you can't let someone like that in heaven. You can't love a scumbag like that." But you know what Christ did there on the cross? He died for scumbags like me. And he takes all of my guilt, all of my shame, all of the accusations, and he wore them in his body. And he's crucified for them. So that now I can overcome the accuser. I can overcome that ancient serpent by the blood of the Lamb. I can look at that serpent. I can look up to God and I can say, "Guilty as charged, but paid in full." And I can celebrate Christ for plundering the strong man's home and delivering me out of it. And if you have placed your faith in Jesus, you are one of those who have been plundered out of the strong man's home, delivered out of satanic oppression, delivered out of demonic oppression, delivered from the accusations, the accurate accusations of your sins, and the inaccurate ones when he chooses to slander your name. God says, "No more. I know they're guilty. But I have forgiven them justly by having the penalty paid." But not only do we overcome the accusations of Satan, we also overcome what you could call a shipwreck of faith. We are able to overcome the destruction of faith. Look at the rest of that verse there in chapter 12, verse 11. "And they conquered him by the blood of the Lamb," that covers the accusations, "and by the word of their testimony," here's a qualifier, "for they love not their lives even unto death." How is their testimony good to overcome Satan? What is it about their testimony? What it is about their testimony that overcomes Satan is the fact that they hold on to their faith even unto death. They'd rather die than let go of Jesus, and Jesus won't let go of them either. Satan is out to shipwreck the faith of those who believe in God. He is out to steal away that gospel seed that falls on the soil, as Jesus predicted or taught us in the parable of the seed and the soils. Satan comes as the bird there to snatch it away as it's heard. Satan comes there to smite out that plant as it's coming up before it can take deep root and bear good fruit. But what does God make us able to do? Overcome his oppression, overcome his advances by the word of our testimony. Because we love not our lives even unto death. Think very closely here on this example. You remember in Job chapter 1, as Satan comes before the throne of God. And he comes there to present himself to God just as all the other angels did. And you remember that God said, "Satan, have you considered my servant Job?" Listen to Satan's words in response to God, Job 1, 9 through 11. "Then Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Does Job fear God for no reason?'" There's the first accusation. Job's just in it because you protect him. Job's just in it for the blessings. Job's just in it for the prosperity gospel. That's all Job's in it for. That's the only reason he follows you, God. He's as shallow as a puddle. He won't hold on to you if you take away the blessings. Verse 10 of Job 1. Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. Satan came before God. He is presented with Job, and he begins to accuse him and say, Job is just money hungry. Job is just pleasure hungry. He serves you because you've made it so easy, but he really doesn't love you. God seemingly ignores the accusations and allows Satan to put Job to the test, to see if he can shipwreck Job's faith, to see if he can destroy Job's faith. But how did Job overcome Satan? By the word of his testimony. Because he loved not his life even unto death. You remember Job's words there towards the end of the book. What does he say of God? As he's sitting there in his boils, scraped with the pot shards, humiliated before his friends, impoverished, nothing left to his name, no family. What does Job say at the criticism of his friends and at the pressure there from Satan? He says, though God slay me, still will I serve him. Job did not love his life even unto death. And he said, I'll serve God to the end of my days, no matter what. Satan couldn't accuse him and Satan couldn't destroy his faith, one or the other. And the same kind of overcoming that took place there in the book of Job is the same kind of overcoming that takes place in your and my life and the martyrs who have gone on before us. They held on to God and they said, though you slay me with that machete, though you point that gun at me in the cafeteria and ask me if I'm a Christian, I'll say yes, because I love God more than I love this earthly life. And so not only has Jesus conquered Satan, he has extended the victory to his people as well. And we are continuing that plundering process. We are continuing to be the light in the world, just as Jesus was when he was here. We are continuing to go out into Mid-County and into Nederland and to Port Neches and to Groves and to Beaumont and to Port Arthur. And we go into the darkness and we share the gospel with people who are under demonic oppression, and God delivers them out by that same gospel he delivers us out of. So how does Satan react to all this? First, you see how heaven reacts here in verse 12. Therefore, rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. This is great. This is wonderful. They get to see everything from above. And they say, heaven has been purified. But there's that word again. But woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows his time is short. You see the picture here? Jesus has come down, the incarnate Son of God, descended from the heavenlies, descended from his throne. He comes into the strong man, Satan. He comes into the strong man's home, plunders him, robs him penniless, ascends into heaven, and Satan wakes up in the morning and sees that Jesus has come. And he's delivered the captives. He's set at liberty those who are captive. He's given sight to the blind. And Satan wakes up and he sees the accomplished work of God. And he is furious, just as you would be furious if your home was robbed in the middle of the night and you weren't awake. And so Satan, in his fury, no longer can make war in the heavenlies. Now he makes war on earth. Now he makes war against Israel and the church, against people like you and I. He has come down in great wrath, furious that he's been plundered, because he knows that his time is short. He has nothing left. He feels like he has nothing to lose. All is lost, and he will take down as many poor souls as he can with him, because he knows his time is short. Satan's not waiting around. He's not being idle by any means. In fact, just a few months ago, as we went through 1 Peter, I preached that verse for you, 1 Peter 5:8, of what Satan is pictured as now here on the earth. Peter says, be sober-minded. Be watchful. For your adversary, the devil, roams around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. That's the world that we live in. A world that is roamed to and fro by Satan, seeking someone to destroy. So the same thing that I said to you all those months ago when I preached that text, because Satan is active, you and I must be proactive. You and I must be, as Peter says, sober-minded, watchful, understanding that the heavenly realities are earthly realities too. Look at verse 13 down through the end. A quick picture of what has taken place here in the aftermath that you yourselves have witnessed. That you yourselves can go on the internet tonight when you go home and you can read this stuff. You can read these things that have taken place. And you can also know the things that will take place by understanding this. And when the dragon, that is Satan, saw that he had been thrown down to the earth, conquered, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. Who was the woman earlier there in chapter 12? Israel. So because Satan is furious that he has been cast down to the earth, he has been overcome, what does he do? He pursues the woman. He pursues Israel. He pursued the woman who had given birth to the child. I can't overcome Jesus, so I'm going to take down as many of his beloved as I can. Verse 14, here it is again. But the woman was given two wings of the great eagle so that she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness to the place where she is to be nourished for a time and times and half a time. There it is again. Though Israel is the object of Satan's fury, she is also ultimately the object of God's love and protection. So who is it that gives Israel these wings of the great eagle so that she can disappear quickly there into the wilderness? It's God. How does this take place? We're not told. But we have seen it over and over again in history. We've seen every time that Israel has been surrounded, every time it seems that Israel is on the brink of destruction, every time it seems that the Jews are about to be systematically wiped off the face of the earth, what does God do? He makes a way. He always protects Israel. Why? Though they may be the object of Satan's fury, they are the object of God's love, ultimately. And not only of his love, but also his protection, because his protection is extended to those who he loves. But the woman was given the two wings of the great eagle so that she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness, to the place where she is to be nourished for a time and times and half a time. Now that is a strange way to talk, but it is a way that has been talked before, and you have a you can have specific understanding as to what a time, times, and half a time actually means. There in Daniel chapter 9 and in chapter 12, you read that same phrase, time, times, and half a time. You read Daniel, who is given prophecy about the end of the days, and he himself also sees a great and terrible dragon. What he sees there is that in the end of days, that there is a great dragon that comes. And he comes for 1 week, and that week represents 7 years. And that halfway through that week, 3.5 years into that week, he betrays Israel. Though he made a strong covenant with many for those 7 years, he breaks that treaty 3.5 years into it, and he makes war on Israel. 3.5 years comes out to 42 months. It also comes out to 1,260 days. Time, times, and half a time. So what is being predicted here is not just an overarching principle that when Satan pursues Israel, she flees into the wilderness and is protected. This is pointing to a very specific time, to the end of days, because Daniel is very specific in the prophecy that he's given, that when that week is fulfilled, that when the abominations that cause desolation have come to their complete end at the end of those 7 years, in the end of the days, that the end will come. And that is when Jesus comes. So you see there at the end of days, when things get most terrible, when they get most intensified during that 3.5 years of the Antichrist's reign here on the earth, that God sovereignly protects his people Israel. Has a place prepared for them to nourish them for a time and times and half a time. Verse 15, it doesn't appear that Satan is pleased with this, that the Jews are allowed to scatter to the four winds of the earth, that they are allowed to be protected and sheltered among the nations of the earth. So what does he do here in verse 15? The serpent, Satan, poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman. I don't have to explain a flood to you people. You have seen it plenty of times. When that river comes out of its banks, nothing is safe, is it? Because that water creeps in everywhere. You can't protect it. You can't stop it. And so that is a picture of Satan's fury, of his anger, of his persecutions that he pours out all over the earth. The serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman to sweep her away with the flood. Oh no! What do we do? Satan has come after the people of God. Satan has come after the Jews. What shall we do? Verse 16 says, but the earth came to the help of the woman. You see that reoccurring theme there? Satan tries with all his might to thwart God and the objects of God's love. But God always comes through in protection for his people. But the earth came to the help of the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured from his mouth. You have seen this take place time and again in history. Think back to all of the nations that allowed the Jews, as they were fleeing persecution from Nazi Germany. They were fleeing genocide and annihilation. Think of all the nations that swallowed the wrath of Nazi Germany, as it seemed that they had poured out their flood of hatred, their flood of genocide across the entirety of the world. You had some nations who stood up. Some of the earth who stood up, and they swallow that wrath. And what do you see for the people of Israel? They're protected. They are nourished, though it would seem that a flood of adversity had come. Same kind of flood that's talked about in Psalm 18 and in Isaiah 43. Verse 16 says, but the earth came to the help of the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured out from his mouth. Verse 17 is interesting because not only is Israel the object of Satan's fury, the church is also the object of Satan's fury. Verse 17, then the dragon became furious with the woman. Why? Because he can't catch her. He can't put Israel to death. He can't annihilate her. No matter how many people on the earth claim jihad against Israel, they cannot conquer her. Then the dragon became furious with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring. Well, who are her offspring? Who are you talking about here, John? What are these things that you're seeing? Who are her offspring? John gets very specific in the thing that he's revealed. And went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. Those are Christians. That is the church. Notice here that just in Revelation chapter 12, you see a very clear distinction made between Israel and the church. You see that God protects Israel, and God makes a distinction between Israel and the church. He loves both, and he protects both. I am not one of those theologians who holds falsely to the idea that the church has replaced Israel. And I don't hold to that because the Bible doesn't teach it. What the Bible teaches is that God's objects of love are Israel and the church, and that God is not done with Israel, that God is preserving her. He is preserving a remnant even unto this day. He is preserving them. Though they are low in number, they are highly favored by God. And the Bible has already told us, in fact, already told us here in the book of Revelation, that on the wings of all these desolations that are coming, when they see the sky turn black and the moon turn blood red, what happens in the nation of Israel? It says 144,000 virgins are saved. They are born again. They call on the name of the Lord. They are born again, and they believe in Jesus. God has a special plan for Israel. That's why I've told you before, why should you have affections for Israel? Because God has affections for Israel. God is not done with Israel, and God is not done with his church. But notice also that though God looks upon us and looks upon the Jews as his objects of love and protection, we are also the objects of Satan's fury. So we have to take the words of Peter very close to heart. Be watchful. Be sober. Your adversary, the devil, is prowling around like a roaring lion, seeking someone whom he may devour. And then at the end of verse 17, it's what we talked about there at the beginning, that little sentence, and he stood on the sand of the sea, talking about Satan, standing there on the beach, looking out over the open ocean where all the sea monsters live, where all the beasts of evil come out of. Satan stands there on the seashore in John's vision. Some of your translations have that verse included at the beginning of 13. Some of your translations have that verse labeled as verse 18. Either way, in any which of those ways, the same thing is true. The end of John's vision here, or rather the end of chapter 12, John sees a picture of Satan looking out over the open ocean, like I said, where all the sea monsters and the beasts of vile evil come out of. Interestingly enough, when verse 13 begins, you see that Satan, essentially what it seems like he does is he is waiting. He is waiting for that first beast to come out of the sea. And as that first beast comes out of the sea, we learn later on that that is the Antichrist. That this deceiver, the accuser of the brethren, has summoned up his Antichrist, the ultimate of all of his deceits in all of history, and the final of his deceits is coming. And that beast will rise up out of the sea, and he will impersonate Christ so as to steal his followers. But the same thing is true. They overcome him by the blood of the Lamb, and by the word of their testimony. You see, we get to read the end of the Bible here, the end of the book of Revelation, and we understand this, that though Israel and the church are the objects of Satan's fury, Israel and the church are also ultimately the objects of God's love, and thereby his protection as well. Church, you have nothing to fear but God. Would you pray with me?